Humility is a fundamental key to meditation practice. It may be the most fundamental, in fact. Because meditation is about going beyond the mind, it's about going beyond the known. An inner quality of humility is a quality that says, there is so much more to this cosmos than my mind will ever be able to comprehend. I don't know everything. I maybe don't know anything. And so I'm open and I'm receptive to what I don't yet know.
Welcome to Meditation Changes Everything with spiritual teacher Craig Hamilton, a podcast exploring the deeper potentials of meditation practice and how it can change every aspect of human life. This episode is part two in a three-part series on the foundations of meditation. Over the next 30 minutes, Craig will discuss four meditation fundamentals that can help you establish a solid footing for your practice. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the show. Here's Craig.
So I'm going to begin with a bit of discussion about the practice mindsets that help support profound meditation practice, the attitudes, qualities, dispositions that enable practice to go deeper. First thing I want to talk about is commitment, which is different from intention. So you could think of intention as something that you ground yourself in. It's the deeper why, you know, your intention. It's kind of the deeper why that drives your practice. It's the driver. And intention is very related to motivation. You know, intention is the sort of source of your motivation to practice. Now, commitment is something different because, see, the interesting thing about commitment is something that can be there even if you have a weak intention. It's something that can be there rock solid even if you don't have any motivation to do your practice. And this is important because, see, where commitment, the place I really want to bring it to here, because we can speak about it in a lot of different ways, and speak about our commitment to awakening, which is a bigger piece, but it's almost, intention's almost more powerful in that context, though, an intention to awaken than a commitment to awaken. But commitment's really potent when it comes to meditation, because meditation's a practice, and for it to work, we have to do it on a regular basis. And to do it on a regular basis, we have to have a commitment to do it on a regular basis. Otherwise, most of us won't be as regular as we need to be. Why not? Because if we don't have that commitment as the foundation, what do we have? We have, I'm going to meditate when I feel like meditating. And, you know, if you're lucky and, you know, and if you have a really powerful intention and a lot of motivation to meditate, you might find that you do feel like meditating a lot. And so you do meditate a lot. And that might work for some of us for a while. But even in that case, times are going to come when you probably don't feel like it. And if the only thing driving you to do it is that you feel like doing it today, a lot of days will come when you don't, and then it won't happen, and you won't have that regularity and consistency, and it'll be fits and starts. And a lot of us have had that experience with meditation practice, haven't we? Fits and starts. It's a little bit like physical exercise. People make commitments. I'm going to do this routine every day or 3 days a week, and then extenuating circumstances come up. We don't do it. We lose our momentum. So having a practice commitment is, I'm going to say, essential. So two things that are really important. One is making that commitment concrete, like, I'm going to meditate this often, this much. I'm going to meditate 30 minutes every day, no matter what, or I'm going to meditate an hour every day, no matter what, whatever it is, and that we stick to that. Now, we can do more than our commitment, and that's fine. If you really feel like meditating, or you have extra time, or you want to go deep one day and really do a lot more, that's fine. But to have your solid amount that you're committed to and always do is key. And so we don't want to overcommit, because what happens if we overcommit, meaning we commit to more meditation than we can do? We say, I'm going to do it an hour every day, but we find some days we really don't have the time. We don't do it. We only do half an hour. Now we're undermining ourself. We're undermining our kind of strength of character. We're undermining our own kind of integrity with ourselves. We've set a commitment where we didn't do it, and it weakens sort of our spiritual backbone, and it's very bad in any context to break commitments with ourself and with others, but you know, we're talking about our commitment to ourself here. But I would say particularly in a spiritual context, given what this is all about. So if we're going to have a regular practice commitment, we also need a way to negotiate it if we end up breaking our commitment. Because one of the ways people fall off of any commitment is by missing a day. It's sort of like we make a, and this has been studied by psychologists who study behavior change and how people make changes basically and following through on commitments, et cetera. And they have found that a commitment to oneself represents a sort of contract with oneself, and that once the contract's broken, people tend to let themselves off the hook for the whole contract. You know, once one clause is broken, the whole contract is null and void. So it's sort of like you miss a day of meditation and then you think, well, I guess I'm not committed because I didn't do it. So the next time you feel like not doing it, well, you already broke it. So it's not like you're breaking it again. It's already broken. This is, again, I'm not saying this is rational. I'm saying this is how our minds work. So the way to get around all that is to just have different ways of keeping to your commitment. So if you do have some circumstance, you know, you're traveling, your plane's delayed, you're in the airport, you can't, you know, you get home late and you've got an early morning, you just weren't able to do it. Well, rather than just breaking it, what you do is you say, you have an arrangement with yourself where you say, I'm going to make up my meditation by the end of the week. It could be the end of the calendar week. It could be by the end of the month, whatever you do. But you have your way where you say, I always make it up. So I got an extra half hour to do at some point. I do it. Now I'm caught up. And I'm still in integrity, and the contract's still in place. That's the key. The last thing I want to say about commitment is part of what's great about commitment is that, and I alluded to this earlier, but I just want to highlight one piece. Part of what's great about commitment is that commitment can rescue you even when you don't feel like doing it. See, a lot of us, we think, how do I get the motivation to do something I don't want to do? And it's a reasonable question. You know, I want to meditate. I've committed to meditate, but I don't feel like meditating. I'm not motivated to meditate today. So we think that we have to motivate ourselves to do it. But no, you don't. You don't have to be motivated to do it. All you have to do is be committed to do it and do it regardless of whether you're motivated. And this is true of a lot of things in life. It's not just this. But do you see the difference? Because these are different mindsets. One is I have to be motivated. I have to work up the motivation. I have to get the drive to do it. The other is, no, I have a commitment, so I do it even when I don't want to at all. It's very liberating to have that. Then you're not, you see, even the whole motivation game is a way that we're in bondage to our feelings, which is another aspect of unenlightenment. It's ignorance, samsara, bondage of the human condition, ego, is, you know, I'm a slave to my feelings. I'm a conditioned creature. I do what I feel like, you know, doing. I've got to motivate myself to get myself to do things. Making a radical commitment to something and then just sticking to it is, it's a liberation from the bondage to feelings that characterizes the human condition. you just do it. You try that on anything in life that you know you have a hard time doing. Just make your commitment. Say, I'm going to do it no matter how I feel. And get up early and exercise every day, even if I just don't want to at all that day. I'm just going to do it because it's a commitment. I'm not going to negotiate with myself. I'm not going to try to motivate myself. I'm just going to do it. Just do it. That's the motto of commitment, I guess. So, yeah. Some things to reflect on there. Okay. The second practice mindset I just want to briefly talk about is humility. Humility is a fundamental key to meditation practice. It may be the most fundamental, in fact. Because meditation is about going beyond the mind. It's about going beyond the known. An inner quality of humility is a quality that says, there is so much more to this cosmos than my mind will ever be able to comprehend. I don't know everything. I maybe don't know anything. And so I'm open and I'm receptive to what I don't yet know. I'm open, ready, vulnerable, receptive to where I have not yet been. And it's the quality of humility is a quality of, it's not rejecting what we know. It's not self-diminishment. You know, some of us think, oh, humility, being humble, that's sort of self-diminishing or self-deprecating. It's not really that. There's a very beautiful kind of innocence in humility. There's a quality of never assuming I know. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. We're open to knowing things. You know, we're going to know things. And wisdom, if we're truly humble, wisdom will start to emerge spontaneously of its own accord. But we won't try to own the wisdom. We won't try to grasp onto it. We won't try to bolster ourselves up with it. We won't use it to try to feel safe and secure in an insecure world. We'll allow it to flow. We'll respond to it. But we'll remain in a place of always realizing that at any moment something could overturn my whole worldview. I could discover something that makes everything I think I know and everything I think is important, you know, be shown to be completely upside down, and that I was totally confused. And to be a person who's ready at any moment to discover that you're totally confused about things and to be okay with that, it's a very deep spiritual attainment, really, to get to a place where we're really ready and willing in any moment to have our whole world turned upside down. I hope you can see why that's so important for spiritual life. Because spiritual awakening, if it's anything, it's the force that turns our world upside down, that reveals to us that everything we thought we knew and the way we thought things worked and what we thought was important is in fact not. It was a figment of our imagination. It was a construction of our culture and our mind. And there is so much more than we ever imagined. So that's why I said it may be the most important or most fundamental quality that we can bring to spiritual practice is a profound humility. And so I encourage you just to reflect on that, to cultivate that in your life. It's not just about meditation. Humility is about all of life. And then bring it to your meditation, where you come to meditation really ready to go into the unknown. And from that place, meditation will consistently take you somewhere new. Because you won't be stopping and getting stuck and looking for a certainty and something to hold on to. You'll be relinquishing that, letting go of that. And that makes everything possible. Another foundation for awakening, and this is really a practice foundation. So this is something that is really a foundation of deep practice, is the environment in which we practice. environmental factors. So I want to say a few things about it because it actually genuinely matters. It's not critical. So this is one of the things you could say, I'm going to say you could do a practice of direct awakening in any environmental circumstance. You could do it in the middle of an intense storm, sitting outside on a bench with a raincoat on or not, in, you know, a hurricane force winds and storm, and you could sit and practice it with great difficult circumstances going on and people coming up to you, shouting at you to leave and run away, whatever. You could do it. But there are environmental factors that powerfully support our practice. And one of them is simply, you know, if you can meditate in the same place every day, create a little sacred space in your house or apartment. Or if you have to do it at your office, do it in the corner of your office. But create a little space where you consistently practice and do whatever feels true to you to make it into a little sacred temple. So that might mean just making it very clean and tidy and maybe having a little plant there or something that represents nature because that's meaningful to you. You know, but something that's kind of clean, beautiful, tidy, and it's your spot where you do that. But it might mean putting some sacred objects there that are meaningful to you, even though I'm obviously very post-traditional in a lot of ways. You know, I like having a little Buddha statue around and, you know, a little Tibetan singing bowl sitting there. Just some things that create a little sense of a temple. It's fine. I'm not worried that you're going to become attached to your sacred objects and think they're gods and feel like if they're not there, you can't meditate. I think you're more evolved than that. So having, you know, whatever it is to create your own little kind of sacred temple can be a powerful support. It helps remind you what you're there to do. It helps draw your energy toward the sacredness of the practice. Ideally, don't meditate in a place where you also do work. That's why I was a little reluctant to say office, but for some of us, we're going to find time to practice at work, in our office. But ideally, don't do it in the same part of your office. Don't do it at your desk. You know, go move over into the corner. Have a separate place, even a separate chair or bench or meditation cushion or whatever that you go and you go there and do that. And that's what you do there. If you travel a lot, and therefore you don't get, you know, a lot of the time you're meditating in new places, you don't get to have your little spot, create a little kit that helps you set up your little sacred space. Again, if you want to have a few objects that help you do that, you don't absolutely have to. You can, again, just find a spot near each hotel room and sort of imbue it with, this is my meditation spot, and you just do that over there. That's okay. But, you know, if a few things, a little scarf or a little statuette or whatever, you know, something for you that just helps you go, oh, here's my little meditation temple. Again, not a critical thing. That's a supportive thing. And we want all the support we can get for these challenging practices. Another environmental piece is solitude. Being as far away from other people, unless they're meditating with you, and then that's wonderful. If you can do it with other people, that's powerful support. If you can't, you don't want to be in a place where other people are coming and going and you can hear them and feel their presence and they're doing stuff and the TV's on in the other room. And part of that has to do with noise, which I'm kind of calling its own category of environment, quiet. But part of it just has to do with, you know, it's kind of the energetic of other people doing things around you that draws you out of your quiet little fully focused practice. It's kind of distracting energy. I mentioned quiet. to the degree that you can find a quiet place or ask people, other, you know, some of us, you know, many of us, most of us live with other people. Ask them, hey, I'm going to go do my practice. Can you be quiet? Can we keep it down? Can we have the house be quiet for this half hour when I do this? That's not too much to ask. Maybe you do something in exchange for their cooperative silence. In terms of our visual environment, having good lighting is helpful because it helps us stay awake, supports wakefulness, and having an uncluttered visual environment supports being undistracted. Temperature is part of the environment. What temperature do you think is ideal for meditation practice? A little cool, a little on the cool side, because it helps us stay awake and alert if it's a little cooler. It doesn't mean you have to be cold, but if you could choose to be in a bit cooler room and then maybe wrap a shawl around yourself or put on a vest or something to just stay a little warmer, the cooler air on your face, cooler temperature overall, will help you stay a little more awake, typically, rather than a very warm room, which is a little harder to be as alert. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about environmental factors. Again, it's a relative dimension, but it's a real dimension, and to the degree that you can set that up, I mean, the optimal thing is you've got a separate room in your place that can be your meditation room, but I realize, you know, that's not something everybody has extra space for. So to whatever degree you can approximate that. Right on the heels of environment, I want to talk a little bit about posture and a few other physical body things. So, like environment, posture is only of relative importance, meaning it's not of absolute importance. Some teachers and tradition, at least according to me, some teachers and traditions have rigid beliefs about posture. I don't. I believe that having good meditation posture can support our alertness and our focus for the practice. I don't believe there's any exact way that you have to sit in order to be able to allow the energy to flow in a certain way or anything like that. This is not that kind of a practice. For other practices, it may be very important. What is important here from posture is being relatively comfortable so you can forget about your body for a period of time. Be undistracted by pain. And sitting in a way that requires a little bit of effort is good because, again, it supports our alertness, our presence, our awakeness. So I'm going to briefly discuss what I consider to be ideal meditation posture, and then I'll talk about what to do when you can't do the ideal posture, because many of us can't. We have chronic pain, physical conditions, etc., or acute pain that means we can't sit in what I would label as ideal posture. So I'll talk about those after I first talk about ideal posture, then I'm going to talk about options to sit in other ways or meditate in other ways. So what I'm calling the ideal posture is something you can do either sitting on the edge of a chair or a bench, or sitting on a meditation cushion on the floor, or using a kneeling bench. Any of these are fine. The three things I want to emphasize around posture are, number one, that it's upright and unsupported, meaning you're not leaning back against anything. Your back is not supported. You're sitting upright and you're holding your upper body up, because that requires a little bit of muscle effort and keeps you in this alertness that I keep emphasizing. The second piece is that your knees are a bit lower than your hips, so you're up sitting up a little high that allows your knees to be down lower than your hips. And what that does is it tilts your pelvis forward, puts a natural curve in your back, which is healthy and generally allows you to sit relatively pain-free. Whereas when you're a little more slouched, leaning back, often you're going to find more pain, etc. So good, what would be considered good, healthy, upright posture like that. And again, that can happen on the floor on a cushion or a bench, or it can happen sitting on the edge of a bench or a chair. Sometimes you have to raise yourself up a little, put a cushion on the chair to get you high enough for that to work. So experiment with that if you can. And then the last one is that your head is drawn up straight from your spine. You're not tilting forward, tilting back. It's kind of pulled up toward the sky, pulled up toward the ceiling. And then in addition to that, your shoulders are relaxed, but kind of square, not rolled forward, but also not pulled back tightly where you're putting tension into your neck or your back. You're just, shoulders are kind of squared and relaxed. Your hands position, they can be either resting on your legs or folded in your lap, facing upright. If you like doing a traditional mudra with your hands, that's totally fine. But it's not essential at all, not something I teach. So those are the basics of what I would call ideal posture. If you have chronic or acute physical issues that make it hard to do that, then here's what I would say. Try to find a way to sit that best approximates that. That would be step one. So if you can sit upright in good posture with your back supported, like you've got a firm chair with a lumbar pillow, that would be a next best thing, because at least it's got you in good posture, even if it's being propped up. That might be second best. If you can't do that, you can find, then I would just say find whatever works for you to be able to sit with minimum pain. So maybe, or even lie down. You could lie down on your back with your lower legs up on a chair or sofa. That often alleviates a lot of back pain and other pain. Or get one of those zero gravity chairs that takes all the pressure off your joints and puts you in that super comfortable position. Although those things are hard to stay alert in. They're so relaxing. But that's the main thing I would say to anybody who's trying to do it lying down or in a gravity chair, etc., is just, if you do that, you're going to have a challenge with the alert awakeness part. So do it in a well-lit place, well-lighted place. Keep your eyes open to help you stay alert. If you find that is just, you always fall asleep when you try that, you could also try meditating standing up. You can meditate standing up. Just stand in a position and do the practice. That's definitely doable, and it's hard to fall asleep standing up. You could try to do it walking very slowly in a place that you could walk with minimal distraction, an uncrowded park or something where it's wide open space. But it's a little less ideal. It's harder to do that and really give yourself full-heartedly to the practice. It can be a good augment, you know, a good addition to your core practice. All right. Couple other quick things around posture. One is stillness. It's okay to move if you feel an itch or some other discomfort. Well, it all depends how bad it is. Meaning, yes, of course it's okay to move, but it is ideal to be still. It's okay to move if you feel an itch or, you know, getting in pain. Absolutely, we don't want to get distracted by it. But often, something like a bit of an itch or a little bit of pain, you can just sort of continue doing your practice and it will go away on its own. And it is better if we can be still for the period of the practice. The temptation to move, particularly, I'd say this, some people, I've done a lot of retreats, some people can't help but shuffle every few minutes. Try not to be that person who's shuffling all the time. If, you know, once or twice during your sitting practice, you need to readjust a little bit,
to accommodate some discomfort, don't worry about it. It's not a problem. It's not about, there's no absolute need to be perfectly still. But it is a powerful support for the inner stillness. So it's good to strive for it. So the main thing I'm trying to get across here is there should be no physical barrier to meditation. Meditation's an inner practice. Physical posture supports it, but it's not essential.
This podcast is supported by our paying members in Craig's Awakened Life membership program. When you join the Awakened Life, each month you'll receive in-depth teachings and guidance in the practice of direct awakening, including a meditation workshop, 4 guided meditations, and a live online retreat with Craig. And when you register today, you can receive your first month for 50% off. Go to awakenedlifemembership.com to learn more and enroll. If you enjoyed today's episode, we hope you'll share our show with others. And please subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you have a minute to write a short review on your podcast app, we would deeply appreciate your support. You can stay connected to the show by subscribing to our newsletter at meditationchangeseverything.com. Each week, we'll send you new audios and videos from Craig, and we'll also let you know when we release new episodes of the show. If the approach to meditation we've been exploring today inspires you, you are invited to tune into a 90-minute online workshop Craig will be hosting called Meditation 2.0, The Miracle of Direct Awakening. In the workshop, he'll share a powerful new approach to meditation practice and guide you in a series of brief meditation experiments so you can experience it for yourself. You can listen to that at freemeditationworkshop.com. That's freemeditationworkshop.com. Check out our show notes for links to all the ways you can stay in touch with Craig's work. Meditation Changes Everything is created by Craig Hamilton, Susan Fries, Mason Ewald, Stephanie Murphy, Will Bowman, and Richard Klein. From all of us, thank you for tuning in.